curiosity, I think, is in a way, it's like the leading edge of love. It's how you love people with your intelligence. You try to get to know them better. You try to get to know their problems better. So just being kind and loving in general with all the people around you means being quick to be curious. Oh, like what's hard? What's the issue here? I also think it means that we don't quickly jump in to like give them solutions.
Before we get started, if you enjoy these episodes, you might want to explore more at optimorc.com. Our website offers unique content, tools, and exercises to help you thrive at work and beyond. We have an in-depth masterclass, which covers our entire theory of growth. We have daily recommendations for personalized advice, and we have a platform to help groups and organizations learn and practice optimal work together. You can get a free trial at optimorc.com. Now let's get started with today's episode. Hey, this is Sharif here with another episode of the Optimal Work Podcast, joined by Dr. Kevin Majors. Kevin, good to be back here with you again.
Hey, Sharif, great to be back.
Yeah, Kevin, well, you recently shared it with me, an article in Harvard Business Review on the potential role of CBT and therapy and these different approaches to psychology in the workplace. So I thought it could be good to discuss that article and compare and contrast it with our own approach in the coaching class on optimalwork.com.
Yeah, that sounds great.
Maybe we just start by summarizing their approach and how they see CBT in the workplace.
Well, just to set the stage then for it, the reason they're talking about CBT is because it has been shown repeatedly to be the gold standard for psychological interventions. In 2019, there is a systematic review of 34 randomized control trials of CBT for anxiety and depression, showing basically that it does have a clear, significant effect. Now, so CBT works. We know it works. In fact, we also know that it can be delivered by people with a minimum of training, because there have been studies of having healthcare people that are not in the field of mental health deliver CBT in, say, third world countries or places where, you know, where there just aren't CBT therapists available. And those have also shown some promising results. And then they also have this idea that because there is you can have apps that help people in a CBT way. Kind of proving, therefore, that anything works. Like if you are delivering CBT to people, they get better. Because these apps also, some of them have their own, probably not like randomized control trials, but there's evidence these apps work. And okay, so like their conclusion from all of that then is managers could be the ones to give first aid CBT when they see an employee in distress. And this has been a theme recently, just to say, in Harvard Business Review. There's a much greater emphasis recently on mental health issues in the workplace. And that's a general trend, and especially the September-October issue.
Kevin, just to back up a little bit, I guess, it might be helpful to also clarify why they're even talking about applying CBT in the workplace. I think they're prompted by, you know, rising rates of, say, anxiety or depression in the general population, and then also noting that impacts people's work, right? That there's a relationship between those two
Absolutely.
Things.
Absolutely. And yeah, it's now astounding, the rates of anxiety and diagnosable anxiety disorders. You know, in some populations, it's approaching 50%. So there is a recognition that there's like, people are awash in anxiety and depressive symptoms, and that these often are showing in the workplace. And in fact, many managers have faced the question of like, what should I do if, let's say, I go into a conference room and there's an employee crying? Which is then the scenario that in this article in HBR that they go through of, what, you know, like a manager goes into a conference room and finds an employee crying, and then they kind of go like, what should the manager be doing with this employee? And that's kind of the setup. But it's an important thing. Like, think everyone, you know, can think of their place of work. And if you were to come across someone crying, what's the best way to respond? Is there like a first aid, you know, quote unquote, that you should be providing to that person? Because it would seem kind of cold just to go up to the person and say, I think you need professional therapy. That would be like pretty tough, right? So, but I think like, so what can they do? That's the question.
So yeah. And is the right approach then to give the therapy yourself, which is, seems like exactly. Quite the leap.
That's the question. And so they have this model then for how they're telling managers they should intervene. I'll try to like briefly outline it. I think they say that there are three steps: acknowledge, respond, and change. So there's these three different steps. If people are going to check out the article, I'll just say that it's pretty unclear to me like what's in each step, because sometimes things appear in multiple steps. And then sometimes it's said, like, for instance, acknowledging has two steps within it. So the first is to acknowledge that the person is in distress, which is like, hey, I see that you're having a hard time. You sit down and then you know, give them time to respond. Well, that's great. And then the second thing they say is to identify the vicious cycles that are maintaining the distress of the employee, which, and for doing that, they have a four-square technique, which is, it's not like four-square when you're talking about decision-making. It's actually the hot-crossed bun model, which is a very British thing to describe, having four boxes. And so, because I think that's what in America, we don't really have hot-cross buns as far as I know. I know. It gets stuck in the head. So you have the thoughts the person's having, the emotions they're having, the feelings in their body, and then the behaviors that they're doing. And the idea they have is that the manager could like have them work with them and make this four square. Like, okay, what are all the thoughts you're having right now? Tell me about the emotions and what, you know, how you're experiencing these emotions and any other feelings in your body. And you describe whatever is happening in your body. And then what are you doing? Looking for maintenance cycles, or what we call in optimal work lingo, vicious cycles. What is contributing and making it worse? So you try to then help identify for the person like, okay, here's where your avoidance is only making it harder to do the thing and it leads to more avoidance and it becomes more and more challenging the more you avoid it. That's a very clear vicious cycle. In fact, in some way, that's every vicious cycle. All of that is, which is a lot, is what they call step one, acknowledging.
Before we continue, a brief message. If you're benefiting from these discussions, please hit like and subscribe to our channel. Doing so helps us reach more people. So you're not just learning yourself, you're helping others discover a path to growth and flourishing too. Thanks so much for your support. Enjoy the rest of the episode. It doesn't seem like that would be the right thing to do with someone that you encounter crying in a meeting room.
Well, yeah, that's... To me, that would be, the whole thing is like, is unusual. I'll just briefly mention then, the responding means empathy and active listening, which I'm not sure how that can take place after having them do a four square of the, you know, to describe all these things. And then you're supposed to, then you do a step of active listening. And then the last is called changing. And by changing, they mean helping them with reframing. And the other is behavioral changes that they have to take place, like doing more yoga, or reading enjoyable books, or finding like come up with behavioral strategies. By reframing, they're talking about you have to help them to first identify their negative thoughts and then challenge them and then replace them with more positive ones. So like in some ways, this would be the very reason I think that managers shouldn't be doing CBT. That the very way of laying it out, how managers would do it, has in some ways all like what are the biggest difficulties with CBT? And one difficulty is that it's a little bit inhuman and impersonal. And sometimes that can be a real criticism of how CBT is taught and how CBT is done. So that it can seem formulaic. You know, that, okay, here's the formula that we do with everyone. And then you have this kind of stilted and unusual interaction based on filling out worksheets. So this approach is, which is being offered like in a very kind of famous journal for how managers can be helping their employees. In fact, I think highlights all the real problems with how CBT is taught and how it's conceived. And particularly that there's no real acknowledgement of what is the nature of the relationship between a manager and an employee. And is it within the boundaries of that relationship to do cognitive behavioral therapy with the person? So that's a huge question.
Yeah, because it seems like the manager is the person responsible for, you know, say reviewing their performance. So that is always going to be in the background of a conversation like this.
Yeah, like the reason we have therapists, yeah, is because they have nothing. There's no interaction outside of therapy. That's like the whole goal of like having therapy is that there's someone. In fact, if you had a social connection with a therapist, you should not see them. And when I do my malpractice insurance, they ask me the question, do you have any social relationships with your patients outside of the relationship? And it's like a risk factor. Like, so now sometimes like it happens that there are people I know that reach out to me for help, but actually I don't disclose names, but I have to say how many times that's occurred. Just because they want to get a sense, like is this, because it's considered to be risky. They understand that it's going to happen sometimes and that people will reach out to you and that it can be okay. And the only thing is you have to keep a medical record. So they're not saying you can never do it, but it's just to highlight that having a therapy relationship is a very different kind of thing where like you wouldn't go to a therapist who could fire you if you're not compliant with therapy. Like, not fire you from their practice, but fire you from your job.
Right. So how does that differ then from the coaching class? Because we're encouraging people within a work context to help each other grow, and especially a manager with their direct reports or maybe a coach within the organization. But I think we leave it open that, hey, this could be a manager helping to mentor his or her direct reports.
Yeah. So one way that we structured the coaching class is that the setting for it is someone is coming to you for help, asking you to help them to grow in some way. The nature of that request determines then what follows. Like, so is the way that they're wanting your help within kind of, does it fit? So for instance, a student could go to a professor and say, I'm having like difficulty understanding this concept. Like, and can you help me with it? Or in general, I'm having difficulty writing essays the way you want me to be able to write them. Well, that would be then an example of the situation where if the professor had done the coaching class, I think they would actually have the best way of helping that student. You know, and it doesn't mean doing therapy, but it does mean that they try to understand fully what's the challenge that this person is facing. And then how is this challenge an opportunity for this person to grow? And then come up with a practical plan for that growth. Well, that's exactly what you would want a professor to do. You'd want the professor, if you were that student, you would want the professor to be thinking, oh yeah, what's the real challenge here? Maybe it's not just writing essays. Maybe it's actually being able to clearly understand the ideas or to be able to think more thoroughly through the prompt, Maybe it's how they're jumping to a quick conclusion rather than pausing and being more thorough. Well, all of that is the professor's job, right? And so it's, now it is coaching, but it's completely within the relationship that the professor and student would have. Or if an employee going to a manager and saying, I am so stressed out because I'm not making my sales targets. Like, you know, and, you know, this is really weighing on me. Could you help me with this? Then again, you'd want the manager to be fully understanding and encouraging and practical. What's the real challenge? How is this your greatest opportunity for growth? And then practical steps to do it. And that, I think, would be being just the ideal manager. But if the student were going to the professor for dating advice, or if the employee were going to the manager for help with getting elder care for their aging mother, that might be inappropriate. And that's not really the kind of help that the person is there. Now, it could be that they're friends outside of work, in which case maybe there could be more openness to that. But I think that's a little bit tricky anyway to have those kind of tangled friendships.
Yeah. Okay. So what makes our approach different from CBT at work is that the content or the matter that we're focusing on is work related. I mean, it's where what's relevant to that relationship, which is, in the case of the manager with the employee, it's their kind of shared goals as a team, what they're working on.
I can just jump in real quick and say another point there is that the approach that we're talking about is not formulaic, but it is focused on the ideals that you would want to be informing the interaction. And that means we're not trying to tell them, here is the right way of doing it. First, have them lay out all the thoughts they're having, and then see all the emotions, then the feelings in their body, and so on. Like that's like applying a formula. And there's, that doesn't correspond, I think, to any ideal. Now, it may be being understanding, but it's like an odd way of going about being understanding with another person. So I think we keep things human by keeping ideals front and center. And the first ideal is to be understanding as deeply as you can. That means being validating. So in order to be validating to others, you have to genuinely be curious, to be thinking like, how is this person seeing their problem right now? So curiosity, I think, is in a way, it's like the leading edge of love. It's how you love people with your intelligence. You try to get to know them better. You try to get to know their problems better. So just being kind and loving in general with all the people around you means being quick to be curious. Oh, like what's hard? What's the issue here? I also think it means that we don't quickly jump in to like give them solutions. So, which I think is like sometimes as soon as we see like a difficulty, it's like, oh, well, have you tried this? Or how about doing this? Anyway, I think but the ideals of being curious, being compassionate, showing confidence that the person is able to do whatever is being asked, those are all, to me, very human ways of improving interactions.
Yeah. So you mentioned that typically the coaching class is going to be helpful when someone comes to you for help. And this is definitely something that I've heard a lot, is that you can't really force change on people. Change has to come from within that person. I wonder in the case of a manager that, hey, they see ways that, say, that their employees need to grow. Maybe it's just because they know more about the role and their employees' career trajectory and, you know, what the next steps are needed, or because they see, hey, our team, in order to be successful, we need this person to produce more, something of that nature. Can you use these strategies, this approach of being understanding, encouraging, and practical, just of your own initiative, or does it really have to be that the employee comes to you for help?
It could be that you and the employee, if you're the manager, will be coming together to like the recognition that the person does need help. So you might have to structure a conversation, like, and this would happen in the case of, say, an annual review. to point out the areas for growth. Well, that's an important moment then, but it's not that the annual review shouldn't be like highlighting your criticisms of the person. It could be instead a much more positive uncovering of new opportunities and growth trajectories. To be starting to think about like what are the ways that the employee most wants to grow that would fit with the way you as the manager think that they need to grow. So there can be a discussion of like, hey, what would be like, you know, in this, you know, so I don't know what the example would be, but if I were, you know, talking to someone, say about like, if you thought that maybe their contributions in the meetings, that they could be more assertive. So then that would, rather than just giving it as a criticism, like, hey, you're not very assertive in meetings. You know, it would be something like, could, you know, maybe you could take more chances in meetings and presenting your ideas to the team, or to be like, you know, or to be displaying that sense of confidence, you know, in meetings by presenting ideas and then letting people question you on them. And so it could be that being able to present ideas clearly and succinctly and then have people challenge them is exactly the thing that you need. You'd want to help them form an image of where they are not yet. I think it's you know, crucial that people have a sense that like there's something they're stretching for. There's these qualities, not outcomes. There's some these qualities of how they could be that you're going to help them to think about attaining. But then you're just there. It's like the coach is just helping them break it down into steps, think through it, identify the pain points, identify what will be easier, and then also the highest ideals that could be inspiring that change. And that's all what we talk about in the coaching class, being encouraging.
Right. I've also found it helpful, like if you notice something, that you can bring it into that understanding phase where you're letting them explain, you know, their own approach and where they think they want to grow. And then you can ask, you know, one of the things we talk about is asking good questions, A, to draw out more of their experience, but you can also bring up this situation that you've noticed and see if, is that something that they see as an issue or is that something that they want to be working on? So I've also found it helpful to approach that there.
Yeah. I mean, and imagine those interactions. Imagine on the one hand, going into it, if you had zero confidence that they could improve in any way. Just imagine how, like, what would that feel like to talk to someone about their growth, you know, with no confidence? It would be very hard to pull off, right? And probably wouldn't help the person. On the other hand, like, what if you were absolutely confident that they had it in them to be extremely good at this? Or they, like, it's like you already have in your mind the image of how they could be thriving. And that's the source of your confidence. You know that they could do this, that they could live in, you know, a new kind of, I'm always thinking of examples that may not fit in a general audience, but you could think of like, what would it look like for this person to be shining, to be radiant in what they're doing? And you could have it very clear that you would want them, or that you're confident that they could be like that. If they want to get there too, then you can start thinking about what are the steps that could outline this. But I don't think you'd be able to really help others to grow if you weren't confident deep in your heart that they can grow, that they have this capacity to grow, which I think everyone has.
Yeah. Well, that gets to my next question, which is, I think there's a kind of tension between the manager role and then this coaching role mentorship role that we've been describing, where the mentor is, you know, needs to be confident that this person can grow and helping them and so forth. But at the same time, they're wearing two hats, because the other hat is the manager hat, where they need this person to produce, you know, this specific work, and they need these outcomes achieved. And, you know, ultimately maybe they can determine whether that person even stays at the company or not. So I wonder, can these two things, I mean, what's your thoughts on how this can be balanced? Because it seems like in that mentoring relationship, there can be this kind of specter of power lurking over it.
Yeah, and that's going to be always the nature of the manager-employee relationship, that there is the possibility that the manager decides this is not a good fit for the employee. And you could say it however euphemistically or diffemistically, you know, that you want. But it's in the end, the manager has not only the good of this employee to take care of, but the good of the organization. And it is the case that the common good of the company is greater than the good of one person in it. And so I think a manager can have every display of confidence and support in helping people to be their best. But there's also the correspondence on the part of the employee. What would you do then with the employee who, despite continual encouragement and kind of collaborative planning of how they could do things and how they could grow, in a sense, like decides, like digs, you know, their feet in and says, I will not. The manager could actually be displaying more confidence than, I think, by firing them. You know, in the sense that I'm sure that you will find a way to thrive on these things that right now we haven't been able to help you to do. But because of that, I don't see how you can continue here. You know, or at least give warnings and things. So I don't think it's always wrong to fire people. And I think that it can be done in a way that's affirming and in fact shows your confidence that they will get by and that you think that they are capable of rising more to meet the challenges than they have so far.
Yeah. Yeah. One thing we advise people in the masterclass is to be less focused on outcomes and more focused on the ideals, and especially not to see the outcomes that they want to achieve as the ends in themselves. But they're all just kind of markers or milestones as people are growing for them to kind of see, okay, am I growing in the right ways? But they ultimately want people focused on processes and ideals and strategies and being creative and flexible and so forth. Would you go so far as to apply that to an entire company or the manager of a team that, hey, they shouldn't be focused on so much on whether this employee or whether their team or whether their whole company is hitting these targets, you know, these kind of numerical, we need to make X amount in sales this quarter, but they should be more focused on the strategies, the processes, the ideals, and how does that potentially affect the manager-employee relationship?
Yeah, so certainly there are, I know people in situations where they work for companies that pay extremely well, but who eventually fire everyone. So they know that eventually they're going to be fired. But while the gig lasts, it's great. And they can be saving up the money that they're making. To me, that's an inhuman way of working. You know, that the idea that as long as you meet these numbers, we employ you, is demeaning. You know, and so I wouldn't want to use the argument from the common good of the company to justify putting numbers ahead of people and to justify destroying all sense of loyalty that you have to the employees that you have. Like, I think that you can't, so I don't think that, so it's true that managers and people running companies do have to protect the common good of the company. But I think it's also true that they have to be individually dedicated to the growth of every employee. And they have to have a culture of helping people to grow, not just like weeding people out. But it makes me uncomfortable too when companies describe themselves as families. And they say, you know, this is my, you know, we're a family here at this company. Well, no, in fact, the difference is that in families, you can't fire people. And that the bonds that constitute a family are permanent. And so, you know, parents might be struggling with their children and getting them to grow in the ways the parents are confident that they can grow. But of course, they can't fire their children.
Great, Kevin. Yeah, I think that's a very important distinction to make. And then I guess just a final question here for the episode. I wanted to get your thoughts on what you see as kind of the big picture ways that, you know, moving forward, psychology, CBT, and so forth can contribute to flourishing in the workplace.
Yeah, in fact, that's the whole project of Optimal Work, is to bring psychological insights to the workplace. What I wouldn't want to do, though, is to psychologize the workplace, you know, to kind of turn the interactions there into therapy. I'm not sure if the workplace needs more like psychology or psychological, you know, jargon. I think mostly what it needs is ideals. I think that what Optimal Work does, you know, what we try to do is just show how ideals are really front and center in the effort to help create culture and to help yourself to grow and help others to grow. So everything in our approach is really just how can you make ideals front and center? So like we talked about today, like being encouraging, being understanding, being practical. Wouldn't you want a sense in a company, you know, that people are encouraged to be compassionate, to show confidence in each other's growth and their ability to grow? So I think that ideals are a way of, they implicitly carry all of good psychology with them. Everything falls into place. The more we have a sense of aiming for ideals as the guiding light, the more they inspire our actions in a thousand ways that we wouldn't have been able to resolve in advance. Like, it's so important that we learn to turn our attention toward our ideals. And so I think when we think about the workplace, we should just be thinking of what ideals could I be bringing there? How could I incarnate these ideals more fully? What would it look like for me to embody them? So, you know, I think that if managers were really trying to grow themselves according to their highest ideals, it would then be much easier for them to naturally come to the assistance of employees who need help. Not that they're going to do the work for them and tell them, hey, here's what you have to do, but to show them the confidence that there are ways that this can bring out their best.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, wonderful, Kevin. Just to add one final thought. I mean, it seems like what we're talking about, psychology in the workplace to help people work better. I mean, it's insights from neuroscience and psychology to help people understand, you know, stress and focus and things that are relevant to their day-to-day work, not about making a manager into a therapist who's now going to help his employees with people with problems outside of work. Right.
Exactly. I also think it's important that we have tools that people can on their own explore and use. And it's very different for a person to go to a tool that walks them through, say, the steps of reframing, like our reframer exercise, or the steps of how to set up a golden hour. And then they find that, whoa, I just had my best hour of work. Well, having tools that you personally use is empowering. And that's different than having a person in power over you trying to be the therapist for you. So I think it's a completely different thing to make tools available for people, you know, and to try to bring ideals into a workplace than to turn the work relationships into therapy relationships. Those are completely different things.
Right. Good. Okay, Kevin. Well, I think that's a great note of clarity for us to end on today. Thanks a lot.
Very truthful. Thanks for your questions. Nice talking.
All right. Yeah, we'll be back next week. Thanks for tuning in to today's episode. If you enjoyed our conversation and you're looking for more in-depth guidance, check out optimalwork.com, our platform of content, tools, and exercises that will help you thrive at work and beyond. See you next week.